Rulon D. Pope was born and reared in Emmett, Idaho. He received a BS degree from Brigham Young University and a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. Professor Pope joined the faculty at BYU in 1982 after faculty time at Texas A&M University and the University of California, Davis. Dr. Pope, professor of economics, is a distinguished scholar, teacher, and colleague. His research has been published broadly in the most respected journals of economics, and his theoretical and empirical work on how uncertainty influences decisions, especially in agriculture, has had a profound effect on the profession. On at least six different occasions, the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association has singled out his research for awards for its enduring quality and impact. Professor Pope was appointed Fellow of the Association in 1996, and he delivered the Association's Fellows Lecture in 2009. He has served as President of the Western Agricultural Economics Association. At BYU, Professor Pope has served as Department Chair of Economics and as Associate Dean in the College of Family, Home, and Social Sciences. He is a challenging and versatile teacher who's well-respected and well-known by his colleagues at BYU and elsewhere. He is a true example of what it means to be a teacher scholar. Professor Pope is married to Sue Davis Pope, who is here with him. They are the parents of six children, many of whom are with us today. We are, as a university, we are honored this year to recognize him with BYU's most prestigious faculty award, the Carl G. Mazur Distinguished Faculty Award, and look forward now to hearing this traditional lecture that accompanies the award. Please join me in welcoming and celebrating this award for Professor Pope.
Good morning. I have been truly blessed to work with such wonderful and skillful students, such as Daniel Bennett, a recent graduate, and I thank him for his assistance with this lecture. I am also truly humbled by the skill and goodness of faculty, staff, and administrative colleagues. And last, but certainly not least, I thank my family and friends for their love and support. In 2007, Time magazine presented a photo essay from Hungry Planet, What the World Eats, by Peter Menzel and Faith DiLucio. It was beautifully photographed and depicted families from around the world and their expenditures on food. Though not a random sample, it is instructive to see how food consumption varies throughout the world. For the U.S., there is substantial variation in weekly food expenditures between the Rivas household of North Carolina, spending $341.98, the Cavins from California spending $159.18, and the Fernandez family from Texas consuming $242.48. Convenience or prepared foods are displayed prominently in the Rivas family food budget. While the Cavin and Fernandez expenditures suggest more intensive household production of food, household size and composition and perhaps ethnicity seem to matter as well. As to expenditures around the world, it is interesting to look into these beautiful and beautifully photographed faces and see the food that they eat. The weekly sums vary from 34.09 by the Namgay family of Bhutan to $25 by the Abubakar family in Chad to $500 per week expended by the Melander family of Germany. These extreme variations in expenditures on food arise from variations in income, prices, and preferences. Economists have spent at least 200 years sorting out, both conceptually and empirically, how each factor contributes to the mosaic of variations across individuals and through time. In developed economies, large sums are spent collecting household consumption data. In the U.S., these data are typically the Consumer Expenditure Survey, collected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The survey consists of two components, an interview and a diary survey, and over 13,000 households respond to the diary survey alone. Agricultural economists, including some of my own work, is focused on studying the demand for food and as it relates to problems of world hunger in particular. A year after graduating from BYU in economics, I entered graduate school at Berkeley to study agricultural and resource economics. I was impressed by the desire of my fellow students to understand and reduce poverty and malnutrition. In today's policy parlance, my fellow students were interested in contributing to food security. As followers of Christ, we all wish for the well-being of the world's poor. Developed economies also have their own version of food insecurity and programs to ameliorate suffering and malnutrition. Examples in the U.S. are the food stamp program, which is now called the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, and the National School Lunch Program, among others. As I completed my graduate studies, there was considerable optimism as the Green Revolution was well underway, improving crop yields in developing countries. Norman Borlaug had received widespread recognition, including the Nobel Peace Prize, for his contributions to the Green Revolution. Many graduates of my program at the time focused on Asia, and often India in particular, or else Africa. Though extreme poverty reigned in these regions, solutions for the malnourished seemed possible, if not rather imminent. In the intervening years, I suspect that the majority of my graduate school colleagues are both pleased and distressed. Pleased that productivity increases and a focused concern have elevated the number of calories per capita available in the world from 2,435 kilocalories in 1974 and 76 to about 2,900 today, which is well above adequacy for men doing moderate activity. And to further illustrate, much of Asia has had strong economic growth, as exhibited by these slides showing increasing real gross domestic product per capita for Bangladesh, India, Indonesia, and Vietnam, resulting in large increases in food availability in these countries and, on average, a steady retreat from severe malnourishment. However, considering India, more than three-quarters of the population live in households with per capita calorie consumption below the 2,100 per day in urban areas and 2,400 per day in rural areas, numbers that are often cited as the minimum requirements in India. Undernutrition levels in India remain higher than most countries of sub-Saharan Africa, which as a whole has 27% of the population hungry. Infant and child mortality rates are high. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that there are 925 million people who currently suffer hunger or undernourishment. Indeed, the World Health Organization estimates that hunger is the number one killer and threat to health and has as the millennial goal, the first millennial goal, to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. Adequate nutrition or food security is surely the most essential component of well-being among the world's poor. In the past, food insecurity was often seen as a production problem. As successful as the Green Revolution has been at increasing yields and hence reducing prices, Many now view the food problem primarily in terms of improving food distribution and economic growth. Landless, rural, and urban poor may not have sufficient claims on food, even though a country has a net surplus of food. The arguments of Nobel laureate Amartya Sen have been provocative and cogent. As the preface to his remarkable book on famine and poverty states, and I quote, "The traditional analysis of famines concentrates on food supply. This is shown to be fundamentally defective. It is theoretically unsound, empirically inept, and dangerously misleading for policy." The author develops an alternative method of analysis, the entitlement approach, which concentrates on ownership and exchange, end quote. He says what he means. I interpret this take on the food problem as some people commanding insufficient resources to purchase enough food. Indeed, it is useful to note that 80% of the malnourished children in the world come from countries with agricultural surpluses. Although inequality is clearly an important cause of malnourishment, it is apparent that the food security problem is, in the long run, largely an economic growth issue, with 98% of the world's undernourished people coming from very poor developing countries, and the hungry are the poor among the poor. For all net consumers of food, those that consume more than they produce, a large increase in food prices imply that they will be much worse off. Indeed, as did the Bengal famine of 1943, which killed millions of people and so shaped Sen's work, it was likely not food production shortages, but insufficient means to purchase food that caused suffering and death. Food production was up compared to some non-famine years, but fear of a shortage and market disruptions drove prices up while wages were declining with widespread unemployment. Though I have done research on both the production and consumption of food, today, for the remainder of my time, I will emphasize food consumption or demand with a few simple conclusions. Demand is an old topic in economics, and demand for food is among the oldest, and I feared it may not make a suitable presentation today. But then I remembered a saying by Jack Handy of Saturday Night Live that seems only somewhat appropriate here at BYU. When you die, if you get a choice between going to regular heaven or pie heaven, choose pie heaven. It might be a trick, but if it's not, boy. A budget share is the proportion of total expenditures or income spent on a category of consumption. For food, this would be the share or percent of your budget or income spent on food. Here is roughly what annual expenditures and budget shares look like for an average U.S. household as a snapshot. Food, excluding tobacco and alcohol, which seems right, is around 12.4% of the average household expenditures of around $50,000. Note that almost half of all food expenditures were for food consumed away from the home. This is a remarkable change during my lifetime. Let us now turn to how these budget shares compare to people in other countries and in other times. Ernst Engel, a German economist and statistician, studied food demand in 1857. Table 1 shows the simple methods of analysis that he used, summarizing 199 Belgium households with data provided by Duke Patillo. Looking at the first row, notice the decreasing shares of expenditures on food as income increases. Here is the same representation in chart form. Engel emphasized from this data one result that is now famously known, well, famous to economists, known as Engel's Law. And I quote, "The poorer is a family, the greater is the proportion of the total outgo which must be used for food. The proportion of the outgo used for food, other things being equal, is the best measure of the material standard of living of a population," unquote. Assuming prices are constant, Engel's Law can be graphically depicted in two equivalent ways. The first shows a declining budget share of food graphed against income on the horizontal axis. The second shows a more conventional Engel curve, which displays that while food consumption increases with income, it rises less than proportionately to income, holding the prices of goods fixed. Engel exclaimed that Luple and Duke Petillo, those providing the data, had delivered the pearls but not the string, presumably meaning that the pearls were the data, but the string was the analysis that illuminated or exhibited the pearls. Engel's Law is a wonderful example of the inductive method in economics. The intuitive and deep empirical regularity of Engel's Law is that the share of resources spent on food falls with increasing income. The impact of Engel's studies soon became apparent. On this side of the Atlantic, Wright in 1889 noted, and I quote, "The remarkable harmony in the items of expenditure between Massachusetts and Europe, shown by the percentage of total expenditure, must establish the soundness of the economic law pronounced by Engel," end quote. There have been accolades with each notable anniversary of Engel's work. On the centenary of Engel's work, the late Hendrik Houthakker, a prominent Harvard economist, exclaimed, "Of all the empirical regularities observed in economic data, Engel's Law is probably the best established." You might be saying that's a pretty low bar, but. And just recently, there was the sesquicentennial paper lauding Engel's accomplishment, showing the robustness of Engel's conclusions across space and time. A few definitions are helpful. Omnivores in the audience might relate to these two goods depicted in the slide. When consumption of a good increases as income is increased, economists call the good a normal good. When consumption of a good decreases with increasing income, the good is called an inferior good. Engel is arguing that food or nourishment is a normal good, but one whose budget share declines as people have more income or wealth. Economists sometimes call such goods necessities. These are not an inherent property of goods, but are a description of a person's behavior as income has changed. Ramen noodles may be a normal good for a missionary. That is, he or she would buy more, having a little bit more income. But post-mission, after selling pest control and security services, ramen noodles would likely be an inferior good. That is, at higher income levels, consumption would fall with increasing income. However, if food, as a group, behaves according to Engel's Law, it will be normal throughout the income range, and the proportion of one's income spent on food will fall as real income or purchasing power rises. Though Engel's analysis was about individuals or groups of individuals, it is useful to think about applications across countries. The World Bank did an international comparison project, the largest project of its kind, to provide a coherent understanding of international consumption. The Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture has updated this study, considering a broad grouping of consumption goods, and countries are classified into low, middle, and high-income countries. Looking down the first column, we see the kind of data consistent with Engel's law. Food expenditures, though higher in wealthy countries, have a much smaller budget share than for poor countries. There are other apparent differences between high-income and low-income countries. High-income countries have larger budget shares for housing, medical care, transportation, and recreation. Engel's law can be viewed another way. A 1% increase in income should increase consumption by less than 1%. Looking at countries in the accompanying table, food demand is relatively more responsive to increases in income among the poorest of countries. One interprets these numbers as a 1% increase in income would lead to a 0.85% increase in consumption of food in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 0.78% in India, and a 0.35% increase in the United States. Thus, food demand is more responsive to income changes in the poorest countries and the poorest of peoples. Now turning to some implications of Engel's law. The implications are truly profound. First, Engel's own finding that the food budget share predicts well-being implies that economic growth is the solution to the calorie or nutrient deficient problem, whether it be a country or a person. If used with care, the budget share for food can be used to infer the well-being, as Engel asserted. Some countries use the food budget share at a point in time, calling it the Engel coefficient, to measure well-being. In this slide, convergence of budget shares between rural and urban residents of Xinjiang region of China was used to argue that both groups had become equally well off. This created a flurry of protests, and eventually bloggers began considering whether prices of goods were similar, rural and urban, which is a key issue. As an aside, many countries use the Engel coefficient to set national poverty lines. The most common method is to divide the cost of a nutritionally adequate diet by the Engel coefficient. The second implication, though the law implies that the demand for food in a household or a country will rise, it tends to imply that the entire agricultural sector falls as a percent of economic activity as a country grows, because income shares going to food fall with growth. Increases in farm productivity will often tend to reinforce this conclusion. Suggestive supporting data are that the farm share of workers in the U.S. fell from 41% in 1900 to less than 2% a century later, and the farm share of gross domestic product has fallen from 8% in 1930 to less than 1% in 2002 in the U.S. China has seen a breathtaking change, where most labor was in agriculture in 1960, about 80%, and today is less than half that amount. South Korea is even more striking, with 61% of labor in agriculture in 1961 and 7.2% today. Indeed, one of the striking differences between developed and developing economies is the proportion of the labor force in agriculture. Engel's law means that economic growth will tend to create an exodus of employment from agriculture to other sectors. The third implication, for poor countries, having a vibrant agricultural sector will be relatively more important because agriculture will be a large proportion of that economy. This conclusion has led international economic organizations like the World Bank to focus more on the development of agricultural markets in recent times as opposed to strategies aimed at development of manufacturing for export for poor countries. Fourth, Policies or market events which raise agricultural prices will have a disproportionately large impact on the poor, who are net food consumers and spend a large portion of their budget on food. This implies that policies intended to raise agricultural prices will reduce real incomes proportionately more for the poor than for wealthy individuals. For example, policies which aren't intended to raise the price of milk in the U.S., as it does, will be regressive in that the poor will suffer proportionately more than the wealthy. The vertical axis of the accompanying graph shows the regulatory burden, and the horizontal axis is income. As is evident, the regulatory burden or diminishment of well-being of the U.S. dairy program falls disproportionately on the poor, which is the left side of the graph. Fifth is the finding by 19th century lawyer, mathematician, and dabbler in economics, Eugene Slutsky. In 1915, he developed a now famous calculus equation that is taught to every major in economics. It predicts that goods with larger budget shares and larger responses to higher incomes will tend, other things be equal, to be more responsive to price. That is, Engel's law implies that the behavior of the poor will be more sensitive to price changes of food than the behavior of the wealthy. As is clear from the accompanying table, food demand is more responsive to price changes for the poor compared to the rich. That is, a 1% increase in the price of food will elicit a 0.86% reduction in food consumption in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 0.74% in India, but only a 0.3% reduction in the U.S. Thus, when there is a commodity price boom, the poor will proportionately shift consumption away from food more than the rich because their purchasing power is severely eroded by the price increase. A recent BBC report tells of the kind of hardship which occurs for net demanders of food when food prices rise, with the headline, "A year of record food prices has forced millions of parents in the developing world to cut back on food for their children." You might ask, what will the poor shift consumption to? This might entail consuming less expensive meals, fewer meals, calories, or nutrients. Hence, combining with the earlier point, the poor will be particularly impacted by price changes. Though Engel's law is so remarkably simple, it might appear that all the questions were long ago settled regarding its validity and procedures to estimate such curves. But this is economics. It depends on what one means by long ago and what one means by settled. I will briefly cover just a few additional points to clarify and explain the research journey. Refining Engel's law raises the questions, what is held fixed as income is varied to create the Engel curve? Does it apply to each individual, countries, or other aggregates? Should expenditure or income be in the denominator of the budget share and graphed on the horizontal axis? These and a host of other issues have been systematically investigated, with most of them reasonably resolved. Briefly, Engel's law is a statistical relationship best stated as the expected or average budget share falls with increases in income holding other things such as prices, education, age, family, composition, risk, and other demographic variables constant. Engel's law does not mean that a family of six with $50,000 of annual income will have a lower budget share for food than a family of two with $40,000 income. Demographic differences or changes alter or shift the Engel curve, as shown in the accompanying slide, estimated from the Consumer Expenditure Survey. larger families have more consumption for a given income level. That's the highest curve. Also, it is known that during the life cycle, consumption expenditures change. Even holding all of the usual demographic variables and income fixed, as shown in the accompanying slide, budget shares for food also change slightly, with highest consumption level in midlife holding other demographics and income constant. One can use straightforward methods to make a correct statement and a consistent statement of Engel's law for an individual, a household, a state, or a country. Indeed, using country budget shares and income for a single time period, one will find Engel's law evident. However, over time, changes in the distribution of income will potentially shift a country's Engel curve. In terms of explaining consumption by income, it is likely best to consider all of the resources available for consumption as income. That is, income is all future expected income and the flow from assets. However, since the future is uncertain, it is sometimes argued that total expenditure is superior to current income because it accounts for a household's expectations of future income. For those who are credit constrained and consuming out of cash on hand, like some, there would be less damage from using current income at one's disposal as the denominator of the budget share. Let me now turn to some newer frontiers. First, economists have verified that separately, food consumed at home and food consumed away from home obey Engel's law. When one considers that leisure is a normal good and the increasing relative cost of preparing food at home, it is unsurprising that the proportion of food expenditures that are away from home has grown strikingly in the last four decades to almost half of all food expenditures. This no doubt explains some of the variations in the types of food and also the total food expenditures seen among households at the very first of the presentation. There is also a normative side to these changing consumption patterns. Food consumed away from home tends to be less healthy. Secondly, one of the significant challenges to Engel's law emerges from researching why people remain poor. One version of this is called the nutritional poverty trap. The argument goes that the poor, if they received additional income, would wish to spend as much as possible on food, thus increasing the budget share, because this would cause them to be stronger and enhance their ability to work in the future and hence increase their future income. Thus, a family spending 70% of their budget on food might spend 100% of an income increase on food, thus increasing the budget share for food and violating Engel's law. Some have used this argument to advance short-term food interventions with the hopes of elevating nutrition and hence future income. Substantial evidence does support the idea that better nutrition will increase productivity for much of the world's population. Sugarcane cutters were found to reduce work capacity by 50% if they were undernourished. A very impressive study of small farms in Sierra Leone found that a 50% increase in calories per person was associated with a 16.5% increase in farm output. In 1995, the World Development Report estimates that stunting, small stature, causes an economic loss of $8.7 billion per year, and that a 1% increase in height is associated with an increase in the wage of 1.38%. Indeed, large increases in food consumption in Europe and in the U.S. is an essential reason for the increase in labor capacity and subsequent incomes, as documented by Robert Fogel. Fogel estimates that in Europe during the 18th and early 19th century, 20% of the potential labor force were excluded from the workforce because of poor diets. It is well known that malnutrition can have long and lasting effects. A sobering finding from this literature is exemplified in a study of Zimbabwe by Alderman Hadinot and Kinsey. After studying the impact of drought on those born in the early 80s, they concluded conservatively that the drought and the accompanying loss of stature, schooling, and potential work experience results in a loss of lifetime earnings of 7 to 12%. However, what is not clear is if people will choose better nutrition and whether they really can escape poverty. To the best available evidence, Indian diets still conform to Engel's law. There is puzzling evidence that Engel curves for calories have fallen over time. That is, fewer calories are purchased for a given expenditure. This can occur because people are substituting more expensive calories, or they are consuming fewer calories because the rigors of manual work have diminished. But I should mention that not all evidence supports Engel's law. A recent study by Kidder and Gurma studying Ethiopian urban households found that the food budget shares do increase with income for the very, very poor. However, Banerjee and Duflo, the two economists who have investigated this matter probably more than any others, seem hesitant to conclude that there is a nutritional poverty trap such that nutritional dynamics keep people in poverty. Third, an area of interest to me is the effect of uncertainty on food demand. Not only expected wealth, but wealth at risk are important for determining consumption. This recent downturn may provide the basis for an empirical strategy to identify these effects. Recall that a number of grocery stores went out of business during this time. One might call this effect the precautionary motive for food consumption. This can cut two ways, as we are clearly counseled by our church leaders. Be prepared with food storage and cash or liquid wealth to deal with contingencies. And secondly, be frugal and flexible, able to adapt our consumption behavior to our economic circumstances. This is prudent counsel, and I see preliminary evidence that this occurred during the recent downturn. Let me conclude. Since Engel, economists have struggled to improve concepts, data, and procedures for estimating Engel curves. Engel's law remains intact after these 150 years of study. However, economists today are not likely to respond as did the jubilant Engel, that we have found the string, Engel's law, which illuminated the pearls, the data. We can always wish for more. Perhaps congruent with being the dismal science, one expert recently commented, Engel curve and demand function models still fail to explain most of the observed variation in individual or household consumption behavior. As long as individual tastes are not directly observed, then we are destined to miss some of the richness of the behavioral responses to more income. Yet, it is clear Engel was really onto something very important for an understanding of our changing world. Thank you.